Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. These days, cotton harvest is the highest priority business in Central Asia. And therefore, thousands of people in some countries, including doctors and teachers, are in the cotton fields. Uzbekistan tops the Central Asian countries as a producer and also tops the way people are dragged to harvest the cotton. However, Turkmenistan and Tajikistan also continues the Soviet era tradition as the most important annual event. In this episode of Majlis, our weekly Central Asia podcast, we will discuss the current part of the cotton campaign, its impact on society, objectives of the authorities, and international outcry against it. To discuss the subject, I have Kirill Boychenko, the cotton campaign coordinator, the coalition of NGOs which highlights forced child labor in cotton-producing countries. Kirill, welcome to the Majlis.
Hello, Mohammed. Thank you. I'm happy to join the podcast.
Very nice to have you, Kirill. Umida Niyazova, an activist who runs a special cotton monitoring project, is also joining us. Umida, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting.
Very nice to have you, Umida. Steve Sivertlo, Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher, is joining us. Steve, welcome to the Majlis.
Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you, Steve. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is also joining us. Bruce Panier, welcome to the Majlis.
Always a pleasure.
Very nice to have you, ladies and gentlemen. Umida, let's start with you. Please describe us scenes in the cotton fields of Uzbekistan these days.
Yes, thank you. So since September 10, the mass mobilization of the people for the cotton harvest has been in full swing. My organization, Uzbek German Forum for Human Rights, together with human rights activists in Uzbekistan, are monitoring this forced labor. And so far, we interviewed about 100 people who are directly involved with the cotton harvest. So among them, there are students, heads of organizations, representatives of various professional spheres. And we can say that majority of state organizations' employees are being forced to pick cotton, resulting in significant financial burdens for the families. Mm. Yeah, as usual, the Mahalla committees, local neighborhood committees, have traditionally been involved in forcing people to pick cotton, and they need to bring unemployed people out to the fields, those who are receiving the different social benefits, mostly women and small children.
You mentioned there are public servants on the field, and you also mentioned students there. How the selection process takes place? Who decides? Is who supposed to go, who to stay?
You mean to go to the fields?
Yeah.
It's very simple. So the heads of local administrations, right, named as hakims, they are responsible for the cotton harvest campaign, right, and they just gather heads of different organizations, and they oblige them to bring the employees, the certain amount of people, so from the staff, to go to the fields. Usually people, workers are living in shifts for 15 or 20 days, and then they replace with the next group of their colleagues. And according to our data, so about half, like 50% of the number of employees leaving their like schools or their places, working places, at the same time to pick cotton overnight.
Approximately how many people might be mobilized every year to cotton fields?
We estimate around, it's our very lowest estimation, and we estimate around 1 million people are forcing to go out to pick cotton every year.
Steve, this mobilization every year, it also causes various types of use and abuses of human rights in Uzbekistan. What are your understanding, from the comments that made by Umida on this. What are your concerns?
Well, that's, Omid is absolutely correct. This is a mass mobilization of the entire population in almost a war effort manner. More than a million people. The social services that people try to access. We had a mother lose her baby just a few days ago because the doctors were not in the clinic where she went to give birth. We actually a few days ago just saw another detention of Yelena Orlaeva, one of Uzbekistan's most courageous human rights defenders, along with the photographer and journalist Timur Karpov, who was detained and beaten simply for taking photos in the cotton fields. So, you know, what you have is, and it doesn't look like Mirziyoyev is really doing anything different than and Karimov did. And as we know, he's very, very involved in controlling this agricultural system. You have the government dependent on this revenue and, you know, virtually willing to stop at nothing to keep the population in check and violate the freedom of expression of the population and really try to silence human rights defenders and journalists who speak up about it. So we see really the worst aspects of Uzbekistan come out during the harvest and the true nature of the government and the economic model that that is so central to the way the country operates.
We will definitely discuss about what are the motivations of the authorities behind this. Obviously, there is economy, but it seems, according to my understanding from some comments made by Uzbekistan experts, that there might be some political reasons, too, behind this motivation. We will come to the subject in the second half of the debate. And Bruce, in Uzbekistan, obviously, this year you have a new president, as Steve mentioned. How has this practice changed under the new leadership?
No, I really don't. That it's become ingrained in the system, this whole cotton campaign, and it goes predates even the independence of Uzbekistan. I mean, even going back to the Soviet days, this is something that was forced upon the people in that area for a very long time. Mirziyoyev is from, originally from Jizak, and that's a big cotton area. Hmm. And so I think he would be one of the least likely people to try to change this particular practice. And unfortunately, as I said, I don't see that there has been any change at all. It seems to be, as far as the cotton campaign goes, it seems to be absolutely business as usual out there. And conscription of people, forced labor, is still in effect. And I think he's just, I don't even want to give him credit for the fact he's only been in for like a month. I think that's just what he's used to, and this is the way it's going to be with him in power. It won't be any different than it was with Karimov, because it's just so entrenched into the system at this point. It's cheap, practically virtually slave labor. Huh. That they're using, so the profit margin for once they sell the cotton is huge. And I see that they make reference every now and then to they're going to mechanize it a little bit more, or even I think as of yesterday they had said that they're going to reduce the amount of cotton that's picked by hand by 30% by 2020. Well, we'll see, because like I said, it's become part of the system. It's practically a calendrical event anymore in Uzbekistan. Like it, not like it, the fact is that it's there. It's one of those things that's a constant.
Definitely there is some financial aspect, or the way the system works in Uzbekistan might relate to this, but the tragic stories that some of them mentioned by Steve Sverdlo, the young woman delivering a dead baby due to lack of medics in the hospital in Uzbekistan, I believe it is not a rare case. How much of such tragic stories might be reaching to Mirziyoyev, Bruce?
Well, it's not... the top guy just gives the order out that he wants the cotton picked, and then it kind of filters down. I think the one of the worst aspects of this is that local officials, who are many of them bullies in some ways anyway, it really brings out the beast in them, and a lot of people have committed suicide. Huh. Because the people overseeing the cotton harvest, they come back at the end of the day and they don't have the target figure that they were giving, and they get screamed at and they get slapped around. People have hung themselves. Young women, old men, older men have had heart attacks from getting screamed at about this stuff. So there's, as bad as it is that they force people into the fields, they have to put up with these very, very brutal local officials at times who are absolutely unsympathetic to anything, any of their concerns at all. Their sole goal, aim, is to make sure that they meet this cotton quota. And, you know, woe be to that person who fails to pick the 50 kilograms of cotton that he was supposed to, you know, have picked once in a, you know, every hour or something like that. And so that's, I think that's one of the most disturbing things about it, is as bad as it is to have to go out there and work in those fields, you know, you got someone watching over you who's going to start screaming at you the minute you don't do what they consider to be sufficient work.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and just to jump in for 1 second and say that, I mean, Bruce is right that we've seen university deans beat their students. We've seen, you know, police officers obviously being really brutal. But in fact, we have to mention that Mirziyoyev himself did this as well. We have a report that in the year 2000, when he was a regional governor, he beat up a math teacher because the students of that math teacher were apparently picking cotton too slowly. And even last year, we saw that he ordered the confiscation of cars and cattle and other assets from farmers that were not, you know, that had outstanding debt, even though the debt is a result of government policies. And he was reportedly saying to, you know, to his underlings, go to the homes of the farmers in debt who can't repay their credit, take their cars, take their livestock, and if they don't have any of that, then take the slate from their roofs. And then last year in the Fergana region, we saw a report that when people thought Mirziyoyev was going to be visiting the region, they went out into the fields where they had already picked cotton, and they tried to glue cotton back onto the plants to make it look like they were, you know, busy and hard at work. So that's just Mirziyoyev. And then imagine that, multiply that by the numerous local officials and regional officials that are implementing this across the country.
Very tragic stories, and these are the stories of those who are, you know, sent to cotton fields to collect the cotton. Umita, again, coming back to you, you also mentioned that the public servants, some medics and some teachers and employees of some other institutions are among those who are sent to the field. So in that way, it's also affecting those who are not in the cotton fields. How the cotton campaign period affects the day-to-day work of the various institutions in Uzbekistan?
First of all, I wanted to say about the schools. So despite the decision not to involve school children in the harvest, which was made in 2013, thanks to great pressure from international human rights organization. So the forcing adults to pick cotton remained exactly the same. And we see that the schools are operating now just formally, and half of the staff, at least half of the staff, and we saw schools where 80% of teachers, they've been out in the fields, and like in the whole school, it was only a few teachers who are stayed with the kids. And of course, in this condition, there was no any real schools for the kids. Also, I would like to highlight with some important aspects of two past years harvest. Uzbek authorities had to carry out actually a difficult task and forcibly mobilizing at least 1 million people to the cotton harvest. At the same time, they are conducting so-called joint monitoring of forced labor with international labor organizations. So these days, Uzbek officials, together with the international experts from international labor organizations, are traveling on the fields and they're interviewing people. And the main hope from the Uzbek authorities side, it was that Uzbek people who are living under very, very deep fear of losing their jobs or being expelled from universities, they will not be telling the truth. So that's why we see that independent human rights activists and journalists are not allowed to interview people, are not allowed to travel to the fields. And we see that detention of human rights activists. But at the same time, Uzbek authorities are saying that people are going to the fields voluntarily.
Yeah, quote unquote, voluntarily. Is there any way to escape this? I mean, what are the conditions one can be excused from being sent to the cotton field, Umida?
Oh, yes, you can just buy freedom from picking cotton. It costs now around $100 for 20 days. So it's a kind of price to hire another labor, mordekaiser, who will go to pick cotton instead of you.
Interesting. Krill, the scale of such operation might be massive in Uzbekistan, but it's not the only country in the region, right, with this phenomena. What are your information from Turkmenistan and Tajikistan and the way the campaign is practiced in those countries?
Yes, that is correct. This problem is not only pertinent for Uzbekistan, but also for Turkmenistan. And the cotton campaign, as a coalition of human rights organizations, trade unions, and social responsible investors, as well as businesses, it coalesced together to end forced labor, especially in the two countries, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, because of the egregious violations of human rights in the two countries. So we're looking both at Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, and reports that are coming from both countries are far from what we would like to see. And Turkmenistan, in this sense, is not that different from Uzbekistan. We also see mass mobilization of public sector employees. Again, independent monitors are reporting about children being sent into fields. And the situation is very similar to Uzbekistan. When you, if you want to be free, you need to buy your freedom. The price range is a little different, but it's very similar. And in this sense, unfortunately, but we see both countries are in mass violation of human rights.
On Tajikistan, I just want to add that a few years ago, Tajikistan does not appear to have, on the national scale, centralized forced mobilization of people to pick cotton. But a few years ago, Human Rights Watch did uncover in the Dangara region of Tajikistan, which belongs to the president, his home region, I mean, we did uncover situations where children were being forced to pick cotton during school days and on the weekends. But again, it appeared to be a situation where local officials were abusing the privileges they had and the relationships they had to the government. And, you know, there's a different context there, at least, you know, but still situations do arise. But I think Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan are in a category of their own. Huh.
Let's recap the debate here. Today in the Majlis, we are discussing Central Asia's cotton campaign and its impact on citizens. Discussing the subject with me are Kirill Boychenko, the cotton campaign coordinator, Steve Severlo, Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher, Umida Niyazova, activist who runs a special cotton monitoring project in Uzbekistan, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. To the Majlis. So let us talk a little bit about the policy itself from the authorities' point of view. It's a Soviet-era practice, right, Bruce?
Oh, yeah. They used to, you know, especially when I was there in 1992, people would, that was one of the questions I would ask when I was working out on the farm in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, and people would tell me about the horrors of having to go out there. And of course, in those days, women, children, it didn't matter. You went out, you were picking, you know, a lot of times when you started in September, the temperature could be 40 degrees or above in some of these places. They sprayed insecticide from planes, crop dusted, while people were out there in the fields too, and didn't bother to tell them that they were coming or move them from the field either. So it was absolutely horrible conditions. You know, people cut their hands up and stuff. I went out and picked cotton a little bit myself. It's very, very difficult work.
Yeah.
To try to pick it, at least pick it cleanly and get everything off there. There's little branches in there. Sometimes there's, you know, there's bugs. They want you to try to get some of the seeds out of it, things like that. So to pick a clean bag of cotton is actually takes a lot of concentration. You know, and sadly, at the time, they thought children were best suited for it because they had smaller fingers. It was easier for them to get at it. But, you know, generally speaking, in those days, it was mostly women and children who were doing it. I suppose that hasn't really changed a whole lot, except that there are probably far fewer children out there picking cotton at the moment. But it's hard work. Even today, the shifts can be really long. Some people spend all the daylight hours out there picking cotton, and they're woken up. Because, of course, they're brought out to these areas and kept in a special kind of a barracks or some kind of building or something. And they're woken up before the sun even comes up. Maybe they got a few hours of sleep, and they're told, okay, get ready, eat something, get your clothes on and get out there. So the minute they can start picking cotton, they're at it again. And these are long shifts, hard conditions. And especially in September, like I said, the temperatures are pretty, it's still pretty hot. So it's a long, long, hard day of work.
Right, right. Omida, it's been like 25 years since Soviet Union collapsed, and we are just talking that this is a Soviet era tradition. So how the practice itself changed over the past 25 years?
Unfortunately, this practice of systematic massive forced labor in the cotton sector remained from the Soviet time, and unfortunately these years officials they are not intent to change anything, and it seems like this system very simple, and they don't see any reason why they have to change it. There is no international, like there is an international pressure, but not so significant, and there is no internal resistance because people are too oppressed, and they just keeping this system, which is just comfortable for them. And I have to also say that forced labor also involve farmers, not only just people, employees of different organizations and students, but farmers are also obliged to grow cotton. And this is actually the root of the problem, because government sets up the procurement prices for cotton, and farmers are obliged to sell cotton only to the government. And for many farmers, most of the farmers, to grow cotton is not profitable. And that's why, knowing that farmers just simply don't have money to hire like millions of unemployment people in Uzbekistan, they could hire just people to pick cotton. But government knows that farmers in debt, they don't have this money, and that's why they're forcing employees of different organizations to go out to the fields and kind of help farmers to grow the cotton. And of course, this policy, this system should be changed. But so far, we don't see that Uzbek government really intend to change it.
Interesting. I don't know who wants to take this question, but forgive my ignorance. If this was a Soviet era tradition, then it must be practiced everywhere in Soviet Union in the past, right? But these days, I see this is no more practiced in some other parts of the Soviet Union, even in some of the Central Asian countries. I see Kazakhstan obviously is not having this problem in the level that the other three countries are having, and Kyrgyzstan is in the same situation. So why is that these three countries, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, continues this and not other former Soviet republics? Who wants to jump in?
Well, again, I'd say that I think, you have to have a powerful security apparatus that is willing to surveil the population and control the population in order to conduct a mobilization of this size. Turkmenistan has, related to Uzbekistan, perhaps more, slightly more modest resources, and maybe that, and of course a smaller population, and maybe that's why the scale of abuses is slightly less, although, per capita and in relation to the population, it's a huge and very important human rights abuse. But I think Uzbekistan is really known for the last, as you said, for 25 years, Karimov erected not just a dictatorship, not just an authoritarian system, but really a totalitarian system, where police officers stand in the field, as Bruce mentioned. Mahalla committees, as Omida said, mobilize people that live in their communities and tell vulnerable citizens in the community that they could lose their pensions or they won't get their subsidies. Single mothers, you know, won't be able to feed their kids if they don't go out. So it's a really elaborate system of control, which I think is only possible in a situation, in a political system, where there's no freedom of expression and where human rights defenders and journalists can't even talk about this. Otherwise, it's an abuse on such a wide scale that it's become, you know, quite rare in the world today to see something like this. This is very peculiar, where the government is actually the trafficker in chief.
So you are.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in on that too, I would mention that, you know, Kazakhstan, because since you mentioned it, has privatized its cotton plantations, farms, and mechanized it to a greater degree. Whereas, you know, in the more authoritarian Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan cases, you know, it's so tied up with corruption, because if you're at the top of the cotton heap, so to speak, if you're the one in charge of cotton production in those two countries, then you're taking in a lot of money. So you're cutting your labor costs to practically nothing, you know, because let's face it, in some of these cases, people are getting paid nothing to go out and do this. And in best case scenarios, they're getting paid very, very little. So, you know, there's just a few people that are in control of this, and they're getting all the money off it. Whereas in Kazakhstan, they've sold out different areas, you know, or they like I said, they privatize it. So different companies are running this, and they see the advantages to mechanization. So they're buying the farming equipment that can pick it. And as a last note, I would just say that we just had a report from the Uzbek service here last week or the week before that Uzbeks that can get across the border into Kazakhstan are going to pick cotton in Kazakhstan because they actually make some money out of doing that.
So I'm a little bit confused here about the motivation of the authorities behind this practice. Is it tied to the way they rule the country, or this is the benefit that they get from cotton is driving their motivation to continue this practice?
Well, it's a big cash crop in Uzbekistan, for instance, and you know, it in years when in the early years when the prices of oil and gas and things like that were not so much, cotton was one product. The price might fluctuate a little bit, but it was guaranteed hard currency income for the government to have these huge harvests and sell this off. And it's kind of become part of the national mentality now. You know, there's another aspect to that you were mentioning the Soviet Union earlier, that they build these things as your patriotic duty. It's part of a great national effort, you know, to go out there and get it. I don't think very many people subscribe to that or buy into that very much anymore. But the mentality on the part of the government is still that this is your patriotic duty. And you can see these things, you know, all over Uzbekistan, written on signs and rocks arranged on the side of hills and stuff like that, you know, talking about Pakhta, you know, Pakhta, Bizning, Altinim is, you know, it's our gold, you know. And so this is the kind of message they're trying to get across to the people. It reminds me a little bit of Tom Sawyer or something, you know, where they're trying to make it sound like it's fun and it's something that really helps out your country, when in fact it's just, you know, ripping people off for the most part, getting them to do the hard work, whereas someone else is going to reap the financial benefits of it.
Interesting. Kirill, we were talking about the financial aspect of this entire operation from the authorities' perspective. How much money do you think Uzbekistan might be making out of cotton every year? Any idea?
Some of the estimates tell us that it's about $1 billion. So it's a very significant profit, and what we see is an absolute lack of transparency and accountability for the profits that are coming from cotton harvest. They all go to Selkhoz Fund, and even Uzbek Parliament has no information of how money is being used. And as far as the researchers, independent monitors are concern, no one knows if the money going back to the community.
So the people who are sent to the cotton fields, they don't get anything at the end of the day. Is it what you are saying?
At the end of the day, they would do something for what they could actually earn money, or surgeons would actually heal people in hospitals, and teachers would continue educating students and not spend days and days in the fields, being humiliated, not receiving a payment, or receiving payment that is not substantial and has nothing to do with real work, then you can earn money and support your family.
Right.
And it seems like right now, Uzbek government is trying to show some progress, But as far as real reforms and seeing some practical outcomes of this, so that we can see progress, not visible. Recently, Uzbekistan ratified the ILO Convention number 87. It's the convention concerning freedom of association and protection of the rights to organize. But it still appoints, Uzbek government appoints the leadership of the National Union Federation, which is supposed to be independent, and it's not. And it's not, it's an open secret for inside Uzbekistan and outside of Uzbekistan that the National Union Federation is not independent. And members of the National Union Federation are part of the ILO monitoring units. So that compromises the ILO monitoring mission. Although we did see this as progress, but there are still many questions. And this year, just like Umida and Steve and Bruce mentioned, this year harvest starts from detention, arrests, deaths, and this beginning, and it's happening right now. We're in the harvest time right now, so it is the time for a change. That's why organizations and coalitions like the Cotton Campaign, we're trying to advocate to governments and businesses and trade unions to change the situation.
How to change the situation is obviously a big question. There is obviously clearly violation of human rights taking place in this practice. And you are obviously running a campaign, from the last several years. So any effect that it is having to change the situation, Krill?
See an effect from the Cotton Campaign, and especially in the reduction of number of children that are being sent into fields. But now, as Umida mentioned, according to independent monitors, we see more and more instances of child labor in Uzbekistan, and that is very concerning. We continue to work and engage with the governments that can engage with Uzbek government, and we advocate with companies and trade unions and international organizations. And international financial institutions like the World Bank.
I just wanted to add that forced labor system in Uzbekistan is very unique, and we always have to say this, because Uzbek government usually say that there is a child labor in such countries like Bangladesh, India, and many other countries. Yes, but there is no other countries where forced labor is a state policy. And that means that forced labor will stop in Uzbekistan when Uzbek authority, Uzbek government stop forcing people to go to the fields. And unfortunately, this is the political will, and we don't see that there is a will to change this system.
Steve Umida just said that this is a state policy. So how to achieve this change in the country? How to stop this from being a state policy? Obviously, you raised this issue in various meetings that you have with the other international actors. So what are the roadblocks to achieve this your objective?
Well, I think Kirill and Umida were absolutely right when they said that the major change was the reduction in child labor, which we saw starting in 2013. And I think the lesson of all the improvements, any of the improvements we've seen, has been that it takes enormous pressure, and it takes, as Mumita says, it takes political will. What happened in 2013 to lead to that reduction? After years of an international campaign, after years of a boycott on Uzbek cotton, and significantly after the State Department in 2013 put Uzbekistan on a list of the worst abusers of human trafficking, that's when, shortly thereafter, we saw the Uzbek government actually agree to allow the ILO in to come into the country and do monitoring, and that's when we saw a big drop in child labor. We saw that pressure actually had an effect. We also saw in Europe, and this is actually coming up again right now, the European Parliament took a very important step in 2011 when the Parliament refused to reduce the tariffs on the import of cotton into Europe. And we see that's again coming up for a vote. And unfortunately, we see countries like Germany and the UK and others taking a very conservative position, trying to raise those tariff reductions, lift the sanctions. And our position in the Cotton Campaign is no. You have to imply pressure. That's the only way you're going to see a reduction, is if the Uzbek government understands that there's a price to pay for continuing this practice. So, you know, I think what we're trying to do as a coalition is be creative, look at every piece of leverage that we can identify, whether it's, you know, the apparel brands putting, you know, making this boycott very public, whether it's the European Parliament imposing some, you know, consequences on Uzbekistan, whether or not it's the State Department report. And now, of course, we're looking at the World Bank and what they are doing and the responsibility the World Bank has to suspend any loans that it gives to Uzbekistan if they see forced labor in the areas where the World Bank is working. And so there are a lot of different fronts that this war has to be fought. But I think, you know, unfortunately, it's going to take stronger political will than we're currently seeing in the world to put an end to this practice.
I know a few companies stopped buying Uzbek cotton lately that are, I think, IKEA and then H&M. What are the other companies who no more buying cotton from Uzbekistan? Krill, do you have any concrete information?
Sure. It's actually a big group of companies. Mm-hmm. It's 260 plus companies that signed cotton pledge that they will not knowingly source cotton from Uzbekistan because of fined with hard evidence, child labor and forced labor in cotton production in Uzbekistan. And those are big companies. You can see the list of those who signed cotton pledge, but some of those are Adidas and those that you mentioned and a number of companies from different parts of the world. This is not only the U.S. companies. These are large European brands as well. So we're looking at an international accord in trying to stop this problem, even from the private sector.
Is it anyway making any difference on the ground?
We believe it certainly does, because when we're talking about a huge economical financial profit from cotton harvest, then of course money becomes central here. And if Uzbek government understands that this can influence their profits, they are prone to the change. And we're hopeful that with help from world brands and businesses, we can change this practice.
Okay. Thank you very much, Krill Boychenko, the Cotton Campaign Coordinator, for your insightful comments. Steve Severlu, Human Rights Watch Central Asia researcher. Umida Niyazova, in charge of Special Cotton Monitoring Project in Uzbekistan. Also Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being in the Majlis today.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Until next week, bye-bye.